From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast, hosted by Paul Hanley.
Welcome to the China in the World podcast. I'm excited today to have with me Paul Triolo. Paul is the practice head for geotechnology at the Eurasia Group. It's a new practice at the Eurasia Group, and it's focused on understanding and addressing the global technology policy issues. It includes a pretty big portfolio of cybersecurity, internet governance, ICT regulatory issues, and emerging areas such as automation, AI, big data, ambient intelligence, and fintech and blockchain. That's quite an agenda. Paul served in senior positions within the U.S. government for more than 25 years, where he focused primarily on China's rise as a science and technology and cyber power. He was the lead drafter for a number of widely acclaimed national estimates on China's S&T innovation and industrial policies, as well as cyberspace issues. Paul has been here in Beijing this week with the Carnegie Tsinghua Center, taking part in our U.S.-China Strategic Track 1.5 dialogue, where we had an opportunity to hear from Chinese and U.S. government officials, including our U.S. ambassador in China, Terry Branstad, as well as distinguished experts on the pressing issues in the U.S.-China relationship. Paul, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Paul. Happy to be here.
So as part of our Track 1.5, you spoke on China Made in China 2025. This is something that's getting a lot of attention in the press in the United States and in the West more broadly, in Europe as well. It's a focus of the Trump administration's current trade disputes with Beijing. You could give our listeners just a sense, you know, what is Made in 2020, China Made in China 2025? How has this initiative developed into a major point of tension? And as I think you said yesterday, how has it become the poster boy for U.S.-China trade frictions?
Great questions, Paul. Great questions. Well, let's start briefly with a description of what Made in China 2025 is. It's basically a Chinese government strategy that was developed in 2015 and released publicly, and involves efforts to upgrade China's industrial base. Basically, digitizing and bringing modern communications technology to China's traditional industrial base and improving it for with the technologies, advanced technologies such as artificial intelligence and broadband internet, and basically upgrading the industrial base. And the program involves 10 sectors, including semiconductors, advanced telecommunications equipment, and things like new energy vehicles. So the program, as it was released in 2015, also included a roadmap that included things like quotas for domestic production in some of these areas. And this is what's really gotten the attention of people in Europe and the West.
I just stop you there because face of that, it seems as if this would be a goal, an objective of any developing nation, any nation that wants to become a leader or wants to become a modern industrial society. So, I mean, is this in and of itself a negative thing?
No. I think nobody disputes that China needs to upgrade its industrial base, integrate advanced technologies, and sort of move up the value chain. The problem is that in China, the program has also come with a tremendous amount of government backing, government subsidies, and the perception that it favors domestic companies. And so some of the pushback has been a concern over a distortion of markets in key sectors, particularly things like semiconductors, which are very globally driven and market driven. And there's a concern that all these policies eventually will lead to overcapacity in these sectors, as we've seen in things like solar and steel. And that's really the concern driving us. In addition, in the U.S., I think there's concern over this idea that China is attempting to essentially appropriate the technologies of the future because of programs like Made in China 2025 and other industrial policies and regulatory restrictions around foreign firms. So I think it's come at a time in the U.S.-China relationship where there's already a lot of concern about China because of other programs such as Belt and Road and things like civil military integration. So it's Made in China 2025 is part of a broader package of industrial policies and of initiatives undertaken by the Chinese government in the last 2 to 3 years that has produced this sort of concern in the West centered on Made in China 2025.
So it's not the principle of the notion of moving up the value chain, as you say, or China's goals and objectives. It's the way that it's done with state intervention and in a way that makes it difficult for foreign companies to compete, or ultimately foreign companies being replaced by Chinese companies with a stated primary objective by the Chinese side to do that.
Well, that's become the perception predominantly because of this document called the Roadmap, which was which was a second document that came out of the Made in China 2025 process. It was put together by a group at the Chinese Academy of Engineering, and it included detailed roadmaps for each of the 10 major sectors in Made in China 2025. And again, in each of these sectors, it called for targets by 2020, 2025, and 2030 for domestic content. So the Chinese government's position on this is this was guidance. These were sort of aspirational goals. But the perception in the West is that this is actually sort of a return to some level of planning with a heavy state hand in this. And then what has typically happened in China is local governments then and municipalities will pick up on these kinds of government priority strategies. And so that's the concern then is that all the local investment will again eventually produce the overcapacity issues that we see in some other sectors. So that's sort of the core of people's concerns about 2025.
If you put aside U.S. concerns and European concerns about the way this is being directed or this guidance that's being given in China and the state-led aspect of this, historically speaking, does the evidence suggest that this kind of approach could even work, even without the pushback from the West on this?
That's a really good question. I think the thing to keep in mind here is that we're pretty early on in the Made in China 2025 strategy, and traditionally large government-led efforts like this, top-down efforts, do have a very mixed record of success. So if you look at even just something as simple as, or relatively simple, as semiconductors, where China has been trying for a long time to reduce its dependence, there have been any number of plans since the, going back to the 8th Five-Year Plan, and none of them have really succeeded through a top-down kind of a program. And so I think even on the Chinese side, government officials will admit that some of these kinds of aspirational plans are outdated almost as soon as they're put down on paper. Mm. But the problem is they do come with these subsidies and some of these preferential policies. And so they do have an impact. But I think what's important to remember in this case is that a lot of these sectors in China are already being led by the private sector. And so that's something to keep in mind, and that's where really I think that a lot of the change is going to come. The government will be an important player in some sectors more than others, but yeah, I think that there may have been a bit of an overreaction in the West to think that just because China has an industrial policy that it's going to succeed and it's going to eventually displace Western companies.
And the concerns by the U.S. and the and Europe, in your sense, how are these perceived by the Chinese and the Chinese government? Is this seen as part of an effort strategically or geopolitically to sort of prevent China from being able to compete with the West or contain China, keep it down, as we often hear? Or are they understanding the fact that really this is just about fair competition? We just want our companies to be able to compete in a fair way. And the way we see this effort now is it will give Chinese companies too large of an advantage for U.S. and other companies to compete.
Yeah, I think there's mixed views on this in the West. I think at some level, people recognize China has to move up the value chain. It has to improve these traditional manufacturing industries along the lines of, for example, in Germany of Industry 4.0. So I mean, in other countries, Japan is pursuing a similar strategy of improving its industrial base. So at one level, everybody agrees that China needs to pursue a similar policy. It comes down essentially to the tactics and to the policies that are helping to drive this. And so I think there's sort of a short-term concern about market access for companies in these sectors and preferential policies, and then there's this longer-term issue about the potential for these policies to distort global markets and supply chains. So it's sort of there's a couple of levels going on here. I think the recent problem with ZTE in China has sort of highlighted this issue because in cutting off, for example, the Chinese telecom number two company in China, their access to U.S. components. This has reinforced this idea in China that Made in China 25 really is important, because one of the semiconductor component, for example, is designed to reduce dependence so that Chinese companies aren't always at risk of losing their supplies. So I think that's another issue that's come in more recently and has highlighted the importance of something like Made in China 25.
Try to, if you can, talk a little bit about the Chinese views on this. Someone said, one of the Chinese participants in our Track 2 said, and it was quite powerful, said, you know, our necks are exposed here,
right,
in talking about the ZTE case. And as you say, it reinforced their views that Made in China 2025 is exactly what they should be doing. How are the Chinese feeling on these issues when it comes to semiconductors and other issues where they don't have their own strong efforts in China underway?
Well, this is the issue of what they call in China core technologies. And what they mean by core technologies are semiconductors, and that means things like memory, mobile chipsets, and particularly CPUs, where they're almost in some cases 80, 90, 100% dependent on Western components. It's also things like software also, so things like databases. So companies like ZTE, which has 211 or so suppliers in the U.S., is heavily dependent on U.S. inputs for both its handsets and its telecommunications infrastructure. So I think the ZTE thing really highlighted both the sort of the weakness of the programs and top-down programs to really solve some of these issues. But I think what happened is at the top, Xi Jinping basically doubled down on this, and after the ZTE announcement, toured some memory facilities in Wuhan and basically made the case that, hey, here's an example of why China must redouble its efforts to reduce dependence.
Now, in the U.S., the recent national security strategy highlighted something called the National Security Innovation Base. And it focused on protecting the core of U.S. innovation, much of which is perceived to be being challenged by Made in China 2025. U.S. seems to be increasingly moving towards protecting and developing these key advanced technology sectors. And I wonder, is this the best response from the United States to be able to do that? Is this, what kind of recommendations would you make in terms of how the U.S. should respond?
Well, I think that the big challenge is deciding sort of what to protect. I think there are technologies that clearly have military use, and the U.S. Should try to maintain its edge and protect those. But there's this huge range of technologies that are going to probably likely come under this definition of national security innovation base. Things like artificial intelligence, even things like semiconductors, robotics, automation, biotechnology. And the challenge there is that a lot of these are inherently dual use. But I think the challenge is going to be deciding what to protect, and what to allow, how to allow innovation to happen in these sectors, because particularly for artificial intelligence, for example, the two sectors are very much coupled between China and the U.S. And so
seems to be a lot of collaboration.
There's a tremendous amount
space,
of collaboration.
Right?
Right. I mean, Microsoft and Google are hiring hundreds of Chinese AI engineers in China. Baidu, who we met with last night as part of the dialogue, Baidu President Zhang Yanqin, we talked about that they're setting up research centers in the U.S. And so, yeah, there's a tremendous amount of collaboration. So the danger in the U.S. Trying to protect or to clamp down on investments in certain sectors is that some of this vibrancy and this innovation will be lost between the two countries. And I think that's a real danger going forward.
Let me close on, you know, you mentioned Baidu and Google and sort of Silicon Valley in that context. You've served in the U.S. government for more than two decades, focusing on China's rise as a science and technology and cybersecurity power. Do you see a gap between the way Washington, D.C. views these issues and the way Silicon Valley views these issues? What's, in your mind, the biggest disconnect between policymakers and those that are creating and understanding the technology?
That's a great question. That's a really good question. I think there's a danger in Washington that the policy community is a little bit behind the curve in understanding how some of these very dynamic sectors, technology sectors, are working, how much money is going into them, how much U.S. money is going into China, how much Chinese money is going into Silicon Valley. and how important that be allowed to continue to improve to drive innovation in those sectors. So I think that the policymakers in Washington may have a little bit outdated view of China and how and where the cutting edge is and the critical role that Chinese private sector companies, for example, like Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent play in this. So it's not there is a state role that we mentioned earlier in Made in China 2025, but most of the cutting edge technologies are being driven in China by the private sector, and AI is a good example of that.
And so how do you educate and inform politicians about these very complex and nuanced issues regarding technology?
It's a good question. I think you write op-eds, you engage in track two dialogues of the type that we've had a chance to pursue here in Beijing, which was fantastic. I think the candor and the dialogue was excellent. And I think following these kind of dialogues, pursuing dialogues with policymakers, bringing them into dialogues like this is a way to really help improve the understanding of what's really going on in China. Because it's very fast-paced. It is very difficult to follow and track. And the media sometimes gets locked into certain memes on these issues and doesn't help in terms of driving understanding forward about how innovation is occurring in these key sectors.
Well, we appreciate you participating in the China in the World podcast, but also our track 1.5 over the last 2 days. When we began exploring, introducing an element into our agenda of China and U.S.-China and technology, one of the first names that people recommend was Paul Triolo. So we're delighted to have you join us. And we hope to see you again in July in Washington, D.C. when we do our track 1.5 there.
Well, it was my pleasure to participate. And thank you, Paul, for the opportunity. And I thought it was a very fruitful discussion and one of the best kind of track two dialogues that I've participated in so far.
Well, thanks again. That's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast. I encourage you to explore our site and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next time.